Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, two Utah lawmakers unveil their ideas for bridging a divide between Salt Lake City and the state over the planned inland port. A mob shouting homophobic slurs chases four men leaving the Utah Pride Festival until an employee at a local dessert shop intervenes. Former State Attorney General Mark Shurtleff sues the groups that investigated him in a public corruption probe. And ozone pollution levels spike earlier than normal in northern Utah. Those and other stories on the docket today. In studio for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune outdoors reporter Aaron Alberti. Actually, what's your title now, Aaron? All sorts of things. Yeah.
Health breaking news and general news features.
Got it. Okay. We've got government reporters. Courtney Tanner is with us. Good morning, Courtney.
Good morning.
And also Taylor Anderson. Good morning, Taylor.
Morning, Roger.
As well as columnist Robert Gerke. And thanks for being here as well.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Join this conversation by posting your questions and comments at sltrib.com, or you can call us. We're at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Let's start with the inland port. Robert Gerke and Taylor Anderson, you both reported on this. Gerke, you actually kind of scooped everyone else before a press conference. The inland port, or the Salt Lake inland port, depending upon how you want to brand it, we've talked about it before on the show. The legislature authorized it this past session, and because of some last-minute finagling in the Utah House, Salt Lake City kind of lost control of what they had control over of this, and they lost their cut of the tax increment as well. Their environmental concerns were ignored. That's what passed out of the state legislature. There was talk of a special session. Negotiations between Salt Lake City and the state of Utah were happening, and then those talks broke down, and that's where we were. But then this plan emerged. I guess, Taylor Anderson, I'll start with you. What is the plan, and how did it come to be?
Yeah, it has to do with the city's concerns with the it was kind of the last-minute bill that passed. It was changed in the House and then passed out of both chambers in the last day of the second-to-last day of the session, but it was around 10 p.m. that night. The Mayor Jackie Biskupski, as well as the City Council and Salt Lake City's delegation in the legislature, they all had, I guess, four concerns. You kind of highlighted them. Tax increment, the Port Authority has up to 100% control of the gains that are made after this area is developed, and there should be quite a bit. And they have environmental concerns, as specifically how land use issues are dealt with right now. And there's a kind of a state appeals board that handles those questions, and this bill gives it to the board, which the board's primary concern is developing the area and not so much the land use concerns. So the city's trying to figure out, the city and the state are trying to negotiate over that.
Gives it to the board, but he gives it to the Inland Port Authority Board.
Exactly. Okay.
And so this deal, though, this is a deal that kind of emerged out of a conversation. Maybe you could tell us about what the deal is and who's behind it and maybe who's not behind it so far, too.
Right, right. Well, that was the interesting part is Salt Lake City Senator Jim DeBacchus, who was opposed to the port altogether, which is kind of a different stance than the city council and the city in general has. They're saying that they're willing to accept the port and accept its job-creating possibilities. And Speaker Hughes, who was a main proponent of this thing, and we should probably back up and tell people what an inland port is. It's basically a network of rails. There'll be it's 22,000 acres roughly, and so this is a very big area that will be eventually. They're pointing to Kansas City. The Kansas City port, inland port, is just a series of rails where once goods come over on these massive ships, instead of checking in at customs on these crowded ports on the coast, they just go on rails right into Salt Lake City's port, and then they're shipped out from wherever they're going here.
Is it all rail traffic, or will we have semi-truck traffic as well?
Semi, you know, it's just a distribution hub, essentially, but a lot of rails because that's the efficient way to get it here from the coast. Mm-hmm. But so the deal that Senator DeBacchus and Speaker Hughes came up with, it had to do with those issues. They said the city, and this is kind of loose, there's no bill yet, at least no public bill. There's no talk of a special session to actually pass any of this, so it's all just talk. But Speaker Hughes indicated that he would be open to maybe the Port Authority getting 75% of the gains that are created once this area is developed. The city might get about 25%.
The city and the other entities involved in this.
Good point.
Not just Salt Lake City.
Good point, because that last minute change in the House, it expanded the boundaries to include parts of unincorporated Salt Lake County and West Valley City. So it's not just Salt Lake City, but it's primarily Salt Lake City.
Taylor, before you go to the other sort of facets of this deal, again, as you said, it's just talk so far. You're talking about recouping some of the tax dollars. Did the city originally expect a lot more of the tax money here? I mean, I'm sure a lot more than zero, of course, but weren't they sort of the original instigator of this project from the get-go?
They were, although they do have a development deal with some developers. They've been working on this. It's just undeveloped kind of swampland, arid land. It's not really, you know, we're not talking about built like extending downtown into this part of town. It's west of the airport, and so the city had been working on how it was going to develop this, the Northwest Quadrant, for a while. It's already got a deal in place, and I think that it promised about 70% of the tax increment to the developers that were going to develop the Northwest Quadrant. So 75 would actually be not that different from what it's already going forward with. Slightly different boundaries there, but 75 is different than the Senate bill that the city had been working on in the Senate that was up to 2% going to the Inland Port Authority. So that's pretty different than 100% that ended up passing.
Well, it's a 98% difference.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've talked about the tax increment part of this deal or whatever you want to call it, and then a couple of environmental provisions in this non-binding agreement, I guess we should say. Some wetlands by the Great Salt Lake are taken off the table for development here.
Right, and they also said, I'm not exactly sure how they're guaranteeing this, but that the airport would not be part of the port's boundaries. I don't think it is right now, but it wouldn't be taken over by the Port Authority, which in some other cities it is. You know, they're all part of the same deal, because some of this, again, we're talking about rails, trucks, as well as air cargo. So DeBacchus said, as part of his, you know, quote-unquote list of demands, that the airport would not be taken over, which he said is a concession from Republican lawmakers who control the legislature and have their eye on taking over Salt Lake City's international airport. So if that's really something that's a possibility in the future, I'm not sure how realistic that talk is, but they said, you know, that's off the table as part of this. As part of the land use negotiation, I guess the city would have, if it had concerns about what's going through here or what's stored on site or any other land use issue that it had, they've got 6 months with whoever the controlling entity is of that problem to try to negotiate a deal before it would go to the Port Authority Board for adjudication.
For sort of final resolution.
Right.
This is just sort of a side one, but the coal cars, this is part of the deal that I don't think the city ever necessarily envisioned them coming through in the first place, but coal cars that came through this inland port would have lids on them.
Exactly. Speaker Hughes mentioned that, you know, coal that's trafficked throughout the state, you know, there's nothing in state law that says it has to be covered. And that's actually a pretty significant environmental concern that's popped up in other states where there's, you know, the communities surrounding a rail system. When coal is shipped through there, there's coal dust, and that's not good for, I guess, anybody when that's coming through. So as part of this deal, both storage and rail cars, they're talking about requiring them to be covered when they're stored on the site.
You know, people are seeing dollar signs with this project, and I can't tell you how many times I've heard the phrase, the last developable chunk of Salt Lake City in the past few months. I actually hadn't heard about this project until I think this year myself. I wasn't paying close enough attention, I guess. But Dita Seed, who has worked with city administrations and among others now works with the Center for Biological Diversity, she says, and she said at this press conference, that this will be a disaster for air quality along the Wasatch Front because of the increase in pollution that will come from this. I want to turn this to Robert Gerke, actually. And Robert, Taylor mentioned that Senator DeBacchus wasn't necessarily on board with the project originally, or was opposed to it, actually. Does this thing have to happen? I mean, is the state is definitely full steam ahead on it, and the city was as well. Is there any stopping it now?
Well, there's a possibility that there could be litigation, and I think that's one of the things that you know, that the state, the legislature is concerned about. You know, and that's why they're kind of carving out some of these wetland areas. You know, they're we saw with the Legacy Highway that there was protracted litigation that's delayed that project and increased the cost significantly because of groups that were trying to protect the wetlands. And they eventually struck a deal, but it took a long it again delayed the project and raised the cost. So I think there's concerns about that from either outside groups. There's also the possibility that, depending on who you talk to, I guess, that the mayor had threatened the governor to with a lawsuit when their talks broke down.
Right.
You know, the city says, I think, and the mayor has said more recently that litigation remains an option, but it's not their preferred option, right? They'd rather kind of try to work this out. So, I mean, so on one hand, you do have the city and to a lesser extent the county on board with the, you know, a partnership with the state. The question is, what does that partnership look like? And as you mentioned at the outset, the way this bill passed was there were weeks and months of negotiations between the city and the legislative sponsors. And then when the bill got to the House and the city came and spoke against it, the House sponsors were really frustrated by that and decided, well, forget you guys. We're going to go ahead and run the original bill. And if you don't like it, tough, because we're the legislature and can do what we want. Mm-hmm. So that's how the city found itself in this corner, really, is that they ended up getting this pretty unpalatable bill forced down their throat by the legislature because they can, again, do whatever they want to do.
I want to remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Robert Gricke, in a column this week, you wrote about part of the story being who wasn't included in the negotiations or in the conversation that Senator DeBacchus and Speaker Hughes were having.
Yeah.
And, you know, they paint this as something that they kind of scratched out on a napkin over milkshakes. But the city council, the West Side Democratic representatives, Angela Romero, Luz Escamilla, Sandra Hollins, Aaron Mendenhall, and, of course, Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski herself, not included in these discussions.
Yeah, I mean, so it's kind of hard because, you know, the speaker and DeBacchus said that this was the genesis of this was that they were doing a TV program, you know, a public affairs program that they were doing, and then after the program was taped, they spent like another hour, you know, in the parking lot haggling over this, and it was sort of a very informal ad hoc kind of process. But at no time did they bring in any of the other representatives, and they were the representatives were upset about that. I mean, Senator Escamilla, Representative Hollins, Representative Romero have been kind of working on this with community groups for months, and for one of their fellow Democrats, especially, you know, and in Luz's case, a fellow Democratic senator, to you know leave them out of the loop was seen as a slight, I think, rightly so. And it's also kind of, you know, in my column I point out that it's probably not a coincidence that all of these representatives who represent this area and who were left out of the negotiations are women. And, you know, they're not, you know, so they shouldn't be included just because they're women. They're elected representatives, and they should be included like anybody else who represents this area should be included. But they weren't.
Why though? I mean, why weren't they? Was it just convenient to leave them out? Hughes and DeBacchus have a kind of unlikely friendship, I guess.
And, you know, and Taylor maybe can elaborate on this, but the explanation that they had that was given was essentially that this was just their this was not some grand compromise. You know, and shouldn't be represented as a grand compromise between the city and the legislature. This is a compromise between Jim DeBacchus and Greg Hughes. And so they said, this is our proposal. You know, if anybody else wants to add on to it or come up with their own ideas, or, you know, this is just where we think we can agree.
And Taylor, maybe I will ask you to elaborate. I know that, you know, despite the complaints and maybe the bad optics there, it looks like there is some level of support at the city level, at least for the tentative and kind of theoretical ideas that are being presented.
Right. That was interesting, too, because it's always been the mayor and the city council and the Salt Lake City delegation in the legislature that they've been united in opposition to this. I found out after this press conference that DeBacchus and Hughes held that actually the city council was roped in a week before, and they were part of the discussions that were going on. So, you know, again, they do have that development deal on the Northwest Quadrant. This is kind of almost in line with what they already have. And so it's in their eyes, the city council's eyes, it's better than the deal they have. And they were at least made aware of it. So their reaction was they knew it was happening, whereas the other legislators, they found out when, and and the mayor's office, too, they found out when a press release was issued or when they read Robert Kirky's story that that told about it. So they were understandably miffed when they, or at least surprised, caught off guard when they found out about this.
Mm. I should, just for disclosure's sake, mention that DeBacchus is the host. He's a volunteer host of a KCPW political debate program, Both Sides of the Aisle. Gerke, is it going to take, it'll take a special session of the legislature for the rubber to meet the road here on this?
Yeah,
right?
And I think that's premature at this point. And to be honest, well, I was going to say they don't really need a special session of the legislature to do this. The talk that I've been hearing lately is that they're going to wait and kind of try to address it in the general session in January. The problem with that is at that point, both DeBacchus and Hughes are going to be out of the legislature. The politics of this are pretty interesting too, I think, because you've got two guys who are both lame ducks in Hughes and DeBacchus. They're both on their way out. Hughes is widely rumored to be interested in running for governor in 2020, and it probably helps him to look at like he's a reasonable person who's willing to compromise with the city. DeBacchus has commissioned a poll back in February about whether he would be a credible mayoral candidate if he wanted to challenge Biskupski, and it polled. Came back and said, yes, he probably would be. He's leaving the legislature, and Biskupski's going to be up for re-election, and there's some talk that he would be running against her, and this does kind of undermine her credibility and puts her in a corner, I think, and shows that, Jim maybe is the guy who can get things done with the legislature if that's what he, mm-hmm. if he does ultimately decide he wants to run for mayor.
So some political ambitions in the background here.
It's hard to ignore, yeah.
We have other stories we have to get to, but I'm wondering, Robert, just before we do move on, right now the bill says that a municipality cannot ban the through passage of natural resources. Mm-hmm. Probably trying to prevent a ban on coal, like the sure. one that Oakland, California enacted to try and stop Utah coal going out through an export terminal there. Mm-hmm. Could that? I mean, if negotiations are happening, could that provision of the inland port project, I guess, get revised?
I don't think so. I mean, there's I was talking to Representative Gibson, who was the House sponsor of the bill. I was talking to him recently, and he said that, that if the city wants to ban coal from this port, that's a non-starter. That's non-negotiable from his standpoint. I don't see the legislature being willing to give on that. I think what the speaker was willing to give in terms of having the cars covered is probably as far as they'll go.
Mm. Lastly, just before we head to a break, Taylor Anderson, something that got eclipsed by, I think, the news of the deal was something that you reported earlier in the week, appointments for the Inland Port Board. And the House Speaker, Greg Hughes, he chose to appoint himself to that four-year position.
Yeah, that's right. So he was not only a big backer in the House, and for years he's been a backer of the Inland Port, but the final bill that passed gave him and others in the legislature and the governor and others in these cities appointments to the Port Authority Board, and for his spot he chose himself. So
is it a paid position?
It's not. They get per diem, which is I'm not sure what that is, maybe $100 for each working day, but that's only when they hold meetings and stuff. So it's not a paid position though.
Okay. I'm gonna throw this back to Gerke for one more comment. Hughes, of course, a developer who will be making decisions about development projects here. It's not that long ago now that there were some questions about his role in some land development decisions made when he was on another board, and that was the UTA board.
Mm-hmm.
Can you remind us of that story, Ricky?
Well, this is a long story, I guess, but there was a front runner station that was being built in Draper out in Greg's district, and there were questions about the selection process, because the site that they chose ended up having some Indian artifacts on it. They went ahead and built it there anyway. And the question was whether, the former House Speaker, Greg Curtis, and Representative Greg Hughes, who was on the UTA board at the time, and Terry Deal, who was the developer, who was on the UTA board as well, had some sort of, deal going to do it there. I mean, the fact of the matter is, the kind of money that they're talking about, the kind of development that they're talking about, and the amount of land that they're talking about this port, footprint encompassing, could really make this board a key player, and they're going to be kingmakers in a lot of ways, And so it is an important position. This is years down the road, but it is an important position that is going to be worth watching.
Okay, and we will keep watching it. So many layers of the story just beginning. and stay tuned to more. We need to head to our first break of the show. When we come back, a hateful mob shouts slurs, and people leaving the Utah Pride Festival. Someone stepped in to try to help and is now being called a hero. We'll get that story and others when we come back to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and AARP Utah, a nonpartisan social change organization with a membership helping people 50 and over improve their lives by providing materials, programs, and advocacy on key issues. More information is available at aarp.org.
The Trump administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy has become one of its most controversial. We'll have two takes on separating children from their parents. Former Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson, a famed author who was once a Vietnamese refugee.
It was painful for me because this is where my own memories begin, howling and screaming as I was being taken away.
Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning from 6 to 9 on Utah Public Radio.
You know, laughter is this kind of clumsy, inarticulate way of expressing ourselves, but it's also kind of awesome.
Here's a question. Why do we laugh? What is laughter for? On the next Radio Lab, we wonder about the mysteries of laughter.
Behind the Headlines, I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I am joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government reporters Courtney Tanner and Taylor Anderson, reporter Aaron Alberti, and columnist Robert Gerke. This program is a Friday morning local news roundup, and as always, you are invited to join this conversation with your questions and comments. 801-355-8255. Or you can post them at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com. I spoke to Robert Gerke and Taylor Anderson about a story they both covered, and Aaron Alberti and Courtney Tanner, you both reported on the next story that we're going to cover. Aaron, I'll start with you for the initial details here. This was Pride Weekend in downtown Salt Lake City this past weekend, and the Utah Pride Festival was going on here on Library Square at the City and County Building across the way. Saturday evening, some attendees were leaving the festival, and their night took a kind of turn for the worse. Tell us what happened, Aaron.
Well, a group of four men, is what people tell us, ran into the Doki Doki Dessert Shop on 4th South, saying that they were being chased by a big group of guys who were yelling homophobic slurs at them. And then all of a sudden, this group appeared in the doorway. Young men started gathering at the doorway. So an employee at the dessert shop went over to the doorway. It's like a two sets of doors, so there's kind of a vestibule in between. And he said one of the guys was coming in. This employee, whose name is Terrence Mannery, went out to confront them. He said initially he thought it was like 7 to 10 guys, and he could just tell them to go away. And then he saw it was probably a bigger crowd than that. And one of the guys, you know, started fighting him, pushed him back. Now, some witnesses outside said they saw him come out. They saw him first get pushed, and then others in the crowd started hitting him. He was swinging back. This fight lasted just a few seconds.
Right.
And then the big group of people, which people outside estimated at anywhere from like 15 to 20, heard other estimates of like 10 to 20, but a big group of guys, younger guys, late teens to mid-20s is kind of the range of age estimates, they just ran away.
And do we know anything about them? The description that some witnesses gave makes them sound like, you know, brown shirts or who are they? They're young men, they're teenagers, a mob shouting homophobic slurs.
Yeah, they're young men. Apparently, everyone that I talked to five witnesses, including Terrence. They all said that they were all white, all younger. One woman described them as typical wholesome Utah boys. In terms of appearance,
right.
She's describing them, not in action. And another witness said that they were muscular, you know, blue-eyed blondes is what one person described them as. So, clean cut. Clean cut was an adjective that I heard.
And they haven't. I mean, there was no sort of apprehension of people who were involved in this altercation on the mob side, I guess.
No, they ran away. Terrence said that a security guard from another building started to appear. That another woman outside tried to calm them down, and they just kind of left. They ran away. A Lyft driver who was outside saw them run back through the alley that they'd all come from. Hmm. Behind the building there. So they disappeared, and there isn't, you know, it happened so fast, just a few seconds, everyone said. So, and a lot of people there were just kind of trying to figure out, well, what are we seeing here? What's going on? Is this real? And didn't get out their cameras, so there's no video footage of this or anything.
I want to bring Courtney Tanner in on this in just a minute, but first, Aaron, police are looking into this, and they've kind of solicited help of the public.
Yeah, they have asked for help, so call 801-799-3000 if you have any information about who these people may be. But yeah, they were called to the scene right after, and they are at least investigating the assault against Terrence.
Okay. The four men who were being chased, who entered the dessert shop, people have called it an ice cream shop. We should maybe figure out what that but what happened to them? What did they do?
Well, they left pretty quickly. Their Lyft driver who witnessed it was waiting for mm-hmm. them, and Terrence said that everyone kind of agreed that, look, these guys may still be here. They may still be out there. So they went home, and then I guess they later returned to the ice cream shop to check in on Terrence to see how he was.
Courtney Tanner, jumping over to you now, you wrote a profile about Terrence Mannery, the guy who got it between the mob and the people who were being pursued, and about people who were actually going to the shop, Doki Doki, to kind of support him and say thank you for intervening.
Yeah, there's been a kind of a uptick of people kind of going to the shop, wanting to meet him, wanting to shake his hand, wanting to thank him. And so it's been kind of an outpouring of support.
What does he say about what he did? I mean, is he... I don't know. How does he say why he did what he did?
He said he just felt an obligation, you know, to step in when people are being downtrodden. And he himself is part of the LGBT community. His boyfriend works at this dessert shop, too.
Hmm. You know what, Robert Gerke, I want to bring you in on this as well. A group of young men chasing and yelling homophobic slurs at people leaving Pride. Is that surprising to you, or alternatively unsurprising?
Well, I think it's surprising just because Pride is such an open event. Everybody, you know, the whole point of Pride is to be inclusive and to be supportive of everybody in the community, and then to have people who apparently were intent on targeting a group of people who were there. It just seems like it goes against the entire ethos of the day. Congratulations to Terrence for doing what I hope we would all kind of do in a situation like that, step in and stand up for people who are going to be who are being targeted. And I guess one last thing about this whole thing is that I think it shows that the state needs a workable hate crimes bill. The law on our books right now doesn't work, and even if they do find these guys, prosecuting for a hate crime under state law is going to be impossible, and so we need to get that taken care of.
Courtney or Aaron Mannery, Terrence Mannery, this guy said that he hoped that his action would inspire other people to stand up as well if faced, I guess maybe not with similar situations because he was worried about violence being done, but I don't know. Yeah, who knows? Is that true?
Well, you know, when I talked to him, he said one of the things that motivated him was that the shop was full of customers who weren't in a very good position to mount that kind of defense. He said that there were some seniors, families with children. He was like, if I don't get in the way here, these guys are going to come in and there's going to be trouble, and there's not really anybody else here that can do that. You know, as far as, like, we all wish we would do it, I think that it's, yes, we all do wish that. I think that it's very difficult in a high-stress, almost unbelievable moment of, you know, a kind of explosive violence to summon the will to act quickly, because so many of the witnesses I spoke with said that the whole duration of the attack is what it took them to kind of process what was even happening, right, that it was real, that it was going on. So it is, I mean, and when I talked to Terrence, he said that, because I asked him, you know, have you ever been in a fight like this? I mean, you're running out into a big group of people. Most of us, even if you knew what was going on, wouldn't take on those odds. You'd just get your butt kicked, and for what, you know? But he said, well, I've been jumped like this before, sad to say. So there's just a certain kind of background and fortitude combined there, I think. Yeah. But
there's, again, there's a $5,000 reward for information, Aaron, if people, again, want to convey something to the police. It's
801-799-3000.
Okay. Troubling story and some great reporting from Aaron Alberti and Courtney Tanner on this. Let's jump to some more news from this past week. And Courtney, I'm going to stick with you for a little bit longer. Former Attorney General Mark Shurtleff, he is seeking $60 million in damages from the various entities that investigated him as part of a public corruption probe, or as a couple of a variety of public corruption probes, actually, that took place a couple of years back. Maybe just as kind of a reminder, we should say that prosecutors said that Shurtleff and his successor, John Swallow, were part of a pay-for-play scheme where businesses would essentially get favorable treatment for cash or gifts. They beat those charges, and now Shurtleff is suing. Courtney Tanner, who is he suing? And $60 million sounds like a lot of money. What is he pointing to justify that kind of, request?
So Shurtleff is suing pretty much everyone that was involved in the investigation against him. I mean, that includes Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill, the FBI, the Utah State Bureau of Investigation, some police agents. I mean, it's just a whole long list of defendants, basically. And I talked to him this week, kind of where he came up with this $60 million number, and he told me, you know, it's not outrageous. I've been denied jobs over this. People have Googled my name, and they've seen these charges, which were dismissed 2 years ago. And so they haven't hired him, and his family has faced these medical bills over getting therapy over the police raids. And so this is where he came up with that number.
Okay. Previously, he tried to get reimbursed for the legal fees for the case against him, where he, you know, as you said, the charges were dismissed by taxpayers. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was kind of a wonky ruling. The judge denied it, but Shurtleff can still kind of challenge it on this kind of breach of contract argument. So it could still come up, but he was looking to kind of be reimbursed for $1.1 million in legal fees, which right now is not happening.
Okay. You mentioned the groups who he's suing, Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill, Utah Department of Public Safety, Utah State Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, and others. Have any of them responded to the fact that they're being sued?
I talked to Sim Gill, who hadn't seen the lawsuit this week just yet, so he didn't want to comment quite yet. Yeah, that's where it stands
okay.
Right now.
Robert Gerke, here's another story that you were in on early. The idea at the time was that Utah's top law enforcement office was allegedly taking campaign donations and receiving, you know, beach vacations from people that the Attorney General's office was supposed to be keeping in line or conceivably going after in court. Charges brought against John Swallow and Mark Shurtleff didn't stick, or they were dismissed. Given the news cycle, this feels kind of like ancient history.
It does feel like it was like years ago, huh?
In the luxury of hindsight, though, what do you make of how all of this played out in the end, and what Shurtleff is trying to, you know, recoup now?
Well, do you have a full hour to talk about that?
Unfortunately.
No. Look, it seems like it's not surprising, and I'm sure that both Mark and John's economic situation has suffered as a result of this. In terms of you know, whether there's malicious prosecution, I think it's kind of hard to argue that when the cases were not black and white. I mean, there's not much dispute that they did these things that they were alleged to have done. The question was whether they were illegal or not, and it was an open question at the time that the case was filed. So, you know, Mark did go on vacations with Jeremy Johnson. He did drive his Ferrari. He did fly on his plane. He did take campaign contributions. John did the same thing, and John went on Jeremy Johnson's, you know, houseboat. They went to California and stayed in this villa of this guy who was still under the thumb of the Attorney General's office. So all of these things happened. The question then, when they got to court, was did they break the law? And you know, the jury in John's case and the prosecutor in Mark's case decided that they weren't going to stick, and so that. But to get from there to this was a malicious, vendetta-driven prosecution that Mark is alleging, I think, is going to be a hard case for him to make in court.
How about in terms of the Utah Attorney General's office and what happened? I guess the question that I have is, did it get reformed after all of this? Did things change at the office in a way, I guess a policy way or procedural way?
Well, I mean, when it was Sean Reyes's contention that when he came into office, he was going to change the culture in the office. He did take some steps to try to put controls on the campaign contributions and access that donors have to the office. He still receives a lot of campaign contributions, though, and it's part of having an elected attorney general is that there's going to be political contributions from parties that end up having business either before the attorney general's office or with the state that the attorney general's office represents. So it's a difficult needle to thread sometimes. I think maybe we haven't seen we certainly haven't seen the level of it that we saw with the past two administrations, though.
Okay. Courtney, is John Swallow, who was Shurtleff's right-hand man and then successor as attorney general, is he doing anything similar in terms of suing?
John Swallow still has a pending case, like the one that Shurtleff had denied, but to get his legal fees covered, and his are at $1.6 million.
Okay, of legal fees, seeking legal fees. Well, we will stick with it and follow that story through and come back to you, Courtney, at some point to see what happened. We need to take another quick break here. When we come back, we will turn to other stories from this and also our underplayed stories of the week. Stay tuned for more on Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in just a minute.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the USU Lyric Repertory Company's 51st season opening, June 15th. Presenting Sense and Sensibility, Peter and the Starcatcher, Grey Gardens, and Macbeth. Details at lyricrep.org.
It was a tough week for President Trump. He had to cancel the visit from the Philadelphia Eagles on Monday. He just loves the camaraderie with the athletes. And he sometimes gets a new shirt he doesn't even have to pay for. I'm Peter Sagal. We've also got the Marine Band lined up in case our guest, baseball great Keith Hernandez, decides not to show up. Join us for the News Quiz from NPR.
Join us tomorrow morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Parliamentary elections in Iraq this past May not only set a new course for that country, they also set a new course for the United States.
Muqtada hates the United States. That's going to be a problem. And we're going to have to figure out how do we relate to someone who has defined himself by his enmity toward the United States.
To Behind the Headlines, I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Taylor Anderson, Robert Gerke, Courtney Tanner, and Aaron Alberti. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or commenting at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Courtney Tanner, sticking with you still, ozone levels. It's something in much of northern Utah that we hear a lot about in July and August, but the summer pollution season got kind of an early start this year. Why did that happen?
Yeah, I think it kind of shocked people. It does peak later in the summer, and we're not even technically in summer yet, but we've had 3 days where the ozone concentration has already broken the federal standards.
And why does that happen? What are the culprits here are essentially car exhaust and sunlight, right?
Yeah, ozone's a little weird because it's not a pollutant that's emitted directly. So it forms in the atmosphere when you get heat and sunlight that trigger some of the chemicals that are released from car engines or lawnmowers.
Okay. And it's just earlier than usual because of that mix being here earlier than usual, I guess.
Yeah, it's been kind of an early hot start to summer. We've had temperatures in the 90s already.
Mm. You know, I'm actually earlier than usual going to turn over to Robert Gerke here for a moment and just ask a quick question, which is the culprit here, as Courtney's pointing out, is cars, increased traffic, and then sunlight. This problem is only going to get worse as our population increases or as we, you know, add a lot more traffic for, say, an inland port.
Yeah.
American car culture is kind of bad for our health. What are we going to do about it, Robert Gerke?
Well, I mean, it's an annual battle that the state has to try to wage, and it's not, I guess, not the state. The citizens of the state have to wage, and so you know the obvious one is drive less, take the bus, ride a bike when you can. There's some, you know, some optimism that when Tier 3 gasoline, which is sort of a newer it produces less emissions that are going to trigger this ozone. Once that comes online and is commonly used, we'll see some reductions there. But it's something that, yeah, the state is going to have to grapple with. We've been grappling with it, but it's not going away anytime soon.
Courtney, it's not, I mean, you think of it as just this invisible pollutant, but it has health repercussions.
Yeah, so it's colorless and odorless, so you don't really see it, but it can cause coughing and shortness of breath, and it can damage lung tissue, especially in young children, so it's pretty dangerous.
Hmm. Yeah, and also we've been out of attainment, right? I mean, we have an EPA... a problem with the Environmental Protection Agency because of the fact that year after year we've had a certain level of ozone pollution.
That's right, and the EPA actually set the bar a little bit low. So it's easier to break the standard now. They changed the requirement. And so last year Salt Lake City violated the new standard 20 times in the summer.
20 times,
yeah.
Okay. You know, one thing that I wonder about also is the effect of things like, and this is so nuanced and not something that you reported, Courtney, but of, you know, ride-sharing companies on this where people are... trying to make extra money driving around all day, somebody will have to do a study on that.
Do they add yeah. trips to pick people up and drop people off? You mean, is it increasing the miles traveled?
And is it increasing the amount of ozone pollution that's ending up in our atmosphere?
Yeah, I mean, that's entirely possible. I mean, the point it boils down to is that this is going to be a rough summer, I think, and this is something that parents are worried about. It's something that economic development people say is a problem when they're trying to recruit businesses to come here. There's a lot of facets to the practical day-to-day impact of this kind of pollution on our lives.
Courtney, in terms of protecting yourself, maybe you addressed this already, but if you want to avoid exposure to ozone pollution and its harmful effects, what can you do?
Don't breathe on red days.
Hold your breath.
Yeah, so you can check when those red days are at air.utah.gov, but it usually peaks around 3 to 4 p.m., so they just advise that you not go outside, not do physical activity at that time, you know, keep outside, stay outside maybe in the morning or the evening, but not in the afternoon.
Okay, and there's your bit of advice on ozone pollution. Guys, we're running kind of low on time here, and I'd like to squeeze in one more story that Aaron Alberti reported on this week. And Aaron, not a ton of time, but Ron Rockwell Hansen, he's a Utah resident and former Defense Intelligence Agency worker. He was arrested this week in Seattle. Why did that happen?
The FBI has been investigating Mr. Hansen since 2014 on suspicion that he was either sharing or trying to share sensitive information with China. Now, who he was sharing with and what precisely he was sharing, the charging documents say that he was going to conferences on kind of cyber security and IT security and sharing that material with Chinese contacts, and that there was evidence that he had been receiving money from these contacts. Who exactly these contacts are? Now, they have reports of him making statements that they are intelligence operatives from China. The charges are kind of notably vague on whether that's actually true. But then in 2016, he made contact with a former intelligence associate of his when he was working with the government and tried to enlist him to get information about China. He described it as the China ops, basically any U.S. plans for intervention in China.
Military intervention.
Military intervention in China, and that he could sell it for, frankly, it did not seem like very much money for the value of information like that to the largest country in the world. But then they met up in Seattle to transfer some of this information. Mr. Hansen allegedly told this contact, who at this point was working as kind of a confidential informant with the FBI, to cut a hole in a tree and hide it there. Also not sure if that would be the most plausible instruction for somebody with a background in intelligence security, but
right.
Nonetheless, this is what they said he instructed this operative or this contact to do. And so since he had the material with him, he was going to board a plane to China. They intercepted him just as he was going into the airport.
Well, you know, why wouldn't you just find a tree with a hole in it already instead of cutting a hole in a tree? This is what I want to know, Aaron.
Seems labor-intensive,
I think it's hard to make a really good cover-up of the hole
right.
that doesn't look like yeah. it's not just, planted there.
Next, thank you for answering that question.
Next time on The Americans, right?
Right. Was he paid money for this? I mean, did he actually receive money?
Yeah, he was receiving money from these Chinese contacts, according to the charges. Like I said, the charges don't go into a lot of detail as to who these people are and whether they are certainly, you know, intelligence operatives out of China, but because they're all given little code names, you know, kind of Anglo-sounding names, in quotation marks. So,
It's an interesting. It's a spy novel, Robert Gierke. Before we move on here, your thoughts on this? I mean, my immediate comment is, why do people think they can get away with this sort of? I mean,
yeah.
How do you expect to get away with this?
Well, and this doesn't sound like it was the slickest operation. I don't know. And as Aaron pointed out, I think it's going to be interesting to see what exactly it is we're talking about in terms of the information that was being provided. But turns out the government is pretty good at catching these guys. At least we think they are. Maybe there's a lot of them that don't get caught. But it's going to be a fascinating trial to watch.
What is Aaron? What is he actually charged with? I mean, it's
So they're federal charges. So they're kind of wordy. There's attempt to gather and disseminate defense information. Hmm. Being an agent of a foreign country, or I can't remember what all they were.
Unlawful tree carving.
Unlawful tree carving.
conspiracy to tree carve.
And then this is the last question I have on this, but is he, I mean, he's from Syracuse, Utah, is that correct?
Yes.
Or not from, but he was living there.
Yeah, and he's been here for a while. He was involved with several local businesses here in cybersecurity and information technologies.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Well, with that, guys, we will head to our underplayed stories of the week, the final segment of the show, and maybe I'll start with Robert Gierke and have you jump in on this. What's your pick for underplayed story of the week?
You're sure that's a good idea?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, my underplayed story of the week is... I just lost it. I'm sorry. Taylor, why don't you step in?
Yeah, the Salt Lake County Council approved the zoning change required for this unincorporated piece of land outside of Harriman in southwest Salt Lake County. This developer wants to build, I'm not even sure, like 9,000 units for like 33,000 people to live in. It's one of the densest developments around, and naturally the city kind of backlashed, and Salt Lake County Mayor actually, Ben McAdams, called for a pause to maybe consider this. So it's something that we'll hear a lot more about as Salt Lake County continues to boom, and Utah County and others. So,
well, there have been objections from local residents, right? I mean, this is where most of the opposition was coming from.
Yeah, they said they didn't move to southwest Salt Lake County to live in a dense development. But again, we're going to hear a lot about this in the years to come.
Okay. Maybe I'll turn to Aaron Alberti if you're ready for a pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, new this morning, a story by Kelly Cannon about animals in Hilldale, stray animals, stray cats and dogs, a lot of them being found shot with pellet guns and, you know, regular firearms. Different rescue groups are collecting a lot of animals with very serious injuries, and this has turned into kind of a social media conversation there as to, you know, how much of this is just a part of daily life. Young men, you know, teenage boys have their guns, they want to shoot something, so they just shoot at stray animals for target practice, according to some people that are commenting from down there.
Okay. So a sort of, I don't know, a renewed focus on how people behave as young adults. It seems like something that goes back to the story that you reported on earlier today, as earlier this week as well, when it comes to the Pride Festival. Sorry, jumping in with my own thoughts on that. Courtney Tanner, good point, by the way, Aaron. Courtney Tanner, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Brian Mathley wrote this pretty fascinating piece on this proposal at the University of Utah to bring beavers back to Red Butte Canyon. They were all killed there 30 years ago, and now there's this idea to kind of revitalize that population.
There's a debate on whether or not the elimination of those beavers was good for the canyon or bad for the canyon, and there seem to be two sides to that story in terms of, even on the researcher's side. Check it out at sltrip.com. Robert Gierke, your pick.
Yeah,
so
it came back
story.
To me. I'm sorry about that.
No worries.
I had a little, like, you know, my brain left for a bit. Kelly Stevens, who was the president of Dixie Technical College, was ousted by the board, I guess it was late last year. On Thursday, the board voted 12-1 to reinstate her. She had claimed that she had been ousted because of political vendettas, and there was allegations of blackmail that that you know letters that were sent to board members who ended up the same board members that ended up voting her out of this position. So she was reinstated by a 12-1 vote on Thursday by the same board that had gotten rid of her earlier, given $100,000 in compensation for the unjust dismissal and a $12,000 a year raise on top of that. So she feels vindicated, but there's Ben Wood did this story that was published yesterday, and it's just a fascinating kind of tale of intrigue, I guess, in Utah's sort of higher ed community. And I think there's probably more to come. There's just the behind the scenes machinations on this were really fascinating.
Is this in Dixie State Technical College?
Dixie Technical College,
and
yeah.
It's in
down in St. George, I believe.
St. George. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll keep an eye on that story as well. I'm going to go for my part for my underplayed story of the week with the proposal to build a museum honoring George Washington here in Utah. It's a story by Thomas Burr about this group trying to secure $70 million to build a replica of Mount Vernon on 18 acres in Highland, Utah. And why, you might ask, are they doing this?
Why are they doing that, Roger?
I have no idea. I think it's because they can. It's an interesting thing. $70 million seems like a lot of money and to build a replica of
Mount Vernon. It sounds very tasteful, doesn't it? This is one of those things that it's the 250th anniversary is sort of the target date that they're aiming toward. And so, you know, the bicentennial. I don't know what it is, but that's sort of the target date they're looking at. And they've brought in some fairly influential, prominent people to try to raise money for this. I think the whole Mount Vernon, replica is sort of mind boggling, but you know, it's strange that Utah, which was, you know, inhabited by Mexicans and Indians at the time, is now sort of going to be, I think they said, the largest American history museum west of the Mississippi or something.
Which
like
was sort of the intent.
Or west of the Rockies, I guess.
Right, to try and then there was a debate over whether or not they would have slave quarters that were at Mount Vernon there. And then I just have to wrap up with the quote from Orrin Hatch, who, constantly joking about his age these days, said that he had spoken, the last time he spoke with George Washington, he thought it was a good idea.
Well, Orrin, we're going to miss him when he's gone.
Yeah, okay. Courtney Tanner and Taylor Anderson, Robert Gerke, Aaron Alberti, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you very much for joining us on Behind the Headlines today.
Sure, thank you.
We've got a few people to thank for their part in this show. We've up at Utah Public Radio in Logan, we have Spencer Holsey, also Tom Williams, and others. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting names at this exact moment. But thank you very much for your help in producing this show. Also, Emily Means, who is the regular producer of the show. I'm filling in for her this week. If you want to find more on Behind the Headlines, you can search in your podcast app or go to kcpw.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for KCPW-FM there. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks very much for joining us. We will see you again next week.
I'm Robin Young. President Trump goes to Canada for the G7 meeting. His planned summit with North Korea's Kim Jong-un is next week. Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani says Kim was desperate for that meeting.
Well, Kim Jong-un got back on his hands and knees and begged for it, which is exactly the position you want to put him in.
Is that a wise thing to say? Next time, Here and Now.
Join us for Hour 2 of Here and Now today at noon on Utah Public Radio.
Time, trade, and politics make for some interesting comparisons.
We should beware of the demagogues who are ready to declare a trade war against our friends, weakening our economy, our national security, and the entire free world.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. What happened in the 30 years between that speech and today, next time on Marketplace.
Join us tonight at 6:30 on Utah Public Radio.
Utah Public Radio is a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan. also heard at upr.org.